Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is John Allen Turner, and hopefully you were expecting to see me. If not, you can leave now, and I won't hold it against you. Thank you. Okay, nobody left. Okay, that's good. So, just a little bit of background. My dad is a minister and has been for my entire life, and so I grew up in church. I was one of those sort of born on Friday, in church on Sunday kind of kids. I could walk most churches blindfold by the time I was 10 years old. I know the feeling of the tile floors in the fellowship hall, which clues you into what kind of church we were, because we had fellowship halls. If you need to leave now, that's okay. I understand. These are things that I can say at Pepperdine and not at Freed Hardeman. It's okay, they'll never listen to the recording. So anyway, I grew up with this. And my sister and I like to joke about how we kind of grew up seeing the clowns with their makeup off. You know, we heard all the stories about who was doing what, and we knew which elders were telling racist jokes, and we knew, you know, all that kind of stuff. And we can act as if we're scandalized by that, but I think we're grown-ups now. And we know church people, I'm just going to be honest, some of the meanest people I've ever met in my life know a lot of Bible verses. And usually they have a Bible verse for why they're being so mean, right? And so my dad has spent the majority of his career and adult life working with churches, and when I was growing up, I was determined I was not going to do that. And here I am, right? And so the apple didn't fall far from the tree. I got into ministry accidentally. I did not intend to be in ministry. I went to this august institution of higher learning here at Pepperdine, and came out of school and thought I had some plans set up for the summer after I graduated, and then they all just kind of fell through, and I ended up moving in with my parents, and I was that kid, and I answered the phone at my parents' house when I was 22, and on the other end was a guy named Jeff Walling, who had been my youth minister, and he was actually calling my dad because they had had a youth ministry intern that bailed on them at the last minute. So he was calling my dad to see if my dad knew of anyone who was interested in a youth ministry intern at the last minute. I happened to be the one to answer the phone. And Jeff Walling, because that's how he answered the phone. Jeff Walling said, "Hey, John, what are you doing this summer?" And I said, "Nothing. I got a fat lot of nothing on my plate." And he said, "Well, why don't you come down? Let me buy you a Coke." And so I went down and ended up staying for 3 years doing youth ministry. And that's how I got into ministry. And what I've learned over the years is that churches are messed up places because they're full of messed up people. And what makes them worse is that the messed up people pretend like they're not messed up. And they pretend that the system that they've created is not messed up. And when you try to say, "Hey, this system is messed up. How dare you criticize the bride of Christ?" And I'm like, "But she's got a wart, you know?" I mean, and so what I've discovered over the years of working in ministry, and now what I do is this. I work in leadership development, coaching, and consulting, and I work with churches literally all over the world. And I've come to find out there are only 5 problems. That's it. There are only 5 problems in churches. And everyone wants to say, "Oh, well, you don't know, if you knew our story, you would know." Because our church is a little bit different than most churches, you know. And everybody says that. Our church is a little bit different. And I go, "Okay, why don't you tell me your story?" And they start, and they get halfway through their story, and I go, "Now, let me guess. Then this happened, and then she did this, and then he went over there, and now that's why you're calling me, right?" And they're like, "When did you start working for the NSA? Are you tapping our phones now?" And I don't know your church, but I know churches. And I know churches well enough to know there are only 5 problems. And we'll get to that, but we won't talk much about it, because if you want me to talk a lot about the 5 problems, you'll have to bring me to your church. And you can get in touch with me right here, by the way, on my website, johnallenturner.com, or you can tweet at me, at John Allen Turner. I also do a podcast with Sean Palmer. You guys know who Sean Palmer is? Sean is one of my favorite people, and I'm not just saying that because he's black. Sean really is one of my favorite people, and he and I do a podcast together called Not So Black and White. And we try to address issues that don't have simple answers. Because there's a lot in Christianity that isn't simple. There's a lot that is. It's not easy, but it's kind of simple. But then there's a lot that's really complicated, and those are the issues that we tend to tackle. So I would encourage you to find the best way to listen to that podcast, and you can get a little bit better feel for the kind of work that I do. But I'm going to start with a statement, and this may be the most controversial statement I've ever made in public. I made it a couple of years ago. I was speaking to a room full of preachers, and you want to talk about cognitive dissonance. Like, I threw this at them, and they didn't know whether to light me on fire or to bow down and worship. I mean, it was this is one of those statements that I'm going to encourage you to wrestle with this, because I believe this to my core, that this is the case. There's no such thing as a spiritual solution to a systems problem. Amen. And vice versa. No such thing as a spiritual solution to a systems problem. And I know, you know, we all want to say, oh, everything is spiritual, I get it, okay. But if the air conditioning in your church building goes out, do not pray about it. Call a technician. Right? We all understand, because that's a systems problem. If your car breaks down, you may want to lay hands on it or do whatever you're going to do, but at the end of the day, you better call somebody who understands engine repair and get them to weigh in on it. And this is the real problem. A lot of churches have systems problems, and they're seeking a spiritual solution to it. Why can't we get more volunteers? What's a spiritual problem? Let's pray about it. And listen, I'm all for praying. Don't get me wrong. Pray, absolutely. And create a system for recruiting, training, and retaining your volunteers. Why can't I get my people to give? Let's pray about that. By all means, pray about it. And create a system where you explain to people the importance of financially participating in your mission. There are a lot of problems in your church that we think are spiritual problems that are really systems problems. Now, let me also say this. The opposite is true as well. There's no system solution to a spiritual problem. So that's true as well. If you have immaturity and lack of character in your leadership, you can create systems all day long, but that's eventually going to crash your church because that's a spiritual issue. So the really important thing to do is know which is which. Which is a spiritual problem and which is a systems problem. But this is going to be the big assumption in everything we talk about today and tomorrow. There is no such thing as a spiritual solution to a systems problem. Anybody have a question about this? I want to make sure that we have plenty of time for dialogue, but I know this is like a big assumption, but I want to just put it out there. And if you want to poke at it, by all means, do. I've had people poke at it a lot. So, all right, then let's move forward. Three questions. First question, how many of you actually work for a church? That's the majority of you. Okay, those of you who do, why did you get into this line of work? Surely there was something else you could have done. Did Jeff Walling call you too, or what? What happened? How did you? Why did you get into ministry?
A sense of calling.
A sense of calling. Okay.
Encouraged by others.
You were encouraged by others.
Serve the marginalized.
You want to serve the marginalized? Why else? When you're encouraged by others, because I've been encouraged by others to do some really dumb things too, right? So so it wasn't just that you were encouraged by others. It resonated with you at some level, right?
No clue what I was getting into.
You had no idea what you're getting into. And if I could fly backwards around the world, maybe I would ignore that sense of calling, right? Why else? Why'd you get into this line of work? I'm giving a room full of preachers the opportunity to talk, and they're not talking.
I'm not a preacher, but just because we really cared about the people in that congregation.
Okay.
I mean, we just felt called to work with them and do what we could together was our hope.
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, make a lasting difference.
You want to make a difference, right?
There's all kinds of things that you can do to make a difference. It's temporary, and you look at that and say, well, I can make a lasting difference, and it seems like, wow, why would I invest my time in anything else?
Yes, sir.
Well, I went to get training in the Bible, and then I realized there are a lot of places that really needed people who had the training to preach.
Right. So you saw a need, and you had received this gift of this training, and when your sense of calling lines up with a pressing need in the world, there are very few things that make you feel as juiced up as that. Mm-hmm. I've literally asked this question around the world. I've asked this question of people who are in ministry. I've asked this question of people who are therapists. I've asked this question of people who are social workers. And you know what the answer always is? Always comes back to? I want to help. I like to help people. Right? I mean, at the end of the day, under your sense of calling, under that encouragement from others, under that Bible training, and you see that need, we want to help. Right? We want to make that big, eternal, lasting difference. And we see people who are marginalized and under-resourced, and we just want to help them. Right? That's why we got into this line of work. Second question, what do you enjoy most about your work?
Helping people.
Helping people, right? We love that. What else? What do you love? What keeps you getting out of bed in the morning?
Preaching.
You love preaching. Why do you love preaching?
It's like, that's when I worship. It's just, that's when I feel everything just comes together and I get lost in it.
Yeah.
You know, I hear the word speak to me more when I'm preaching than when I prepare to preach.
Right.
Amazing.
Yes, sir.
Sharing the knowledge of God and His Son to others that don't have that.
Yeah. When you get to reveal something, especially something, and somebody comes up to you and says, I've never thought of it that way. I've never seen it. I've read over that verse 100 times. I've never seen it that way. And you really open it up in a way. Boy, that really touches something deep inside of me, right? Yes.
My favorite thing is when I say something and someone brings it back to me 8 months later and I don't remember saying it.
Yeah.
But they have been immensely blessed by it. Yeah. I feel like God used me and I didn't even know it. So it was very real and satisfying.
Right. Yes, sir.
Well, this might seem trite, but I asked myself if being a Christian were illegal, would there be enough evidence to convict me?
I remember that poster being on the wall in my when I was in a youth group in high school. Yeah.
So it's not unique.
Well, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, but yeah. Again, I ask this question all over the place, and the two answers are always related, right? We got into this line of work because we want to help people, and what we love about this line of work is when somebody gets help. When we are actually able to do something and see the results and know I helped that person. That person's life has been changed because of what I'm doing here. Right?
You do that.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Now, this is interesting because usually when I ask these questions, especially in a room full of preachers, most oftentimes they don't tell me why they got in the line of work. They tell me how. Oh. Well, I went to school here and I went to school there and then I got a job over here and then somebody called me, you know. And this one I ask them, and they kind of hem and haw and talk. This next question, you watch what happens. What frustrates you most about your work?
It'd be okay if one for people.
Some people.
All right, yeah. What else? What frustrates you?
System.
When I ask these questions, the answer to the first one is I got into this line of work because I wanted to help people. The answer to the second question is I get really excited and I just love it when I'm able to help people. And the answer to the third question is I get frustrated when people don't get the help that I want to give them. And it's either because something something in the bureaucracy, something in the system, or just the fact that sometimes people won't get the help that you offer.
Or they don't ask.
They don't ask sometimes, and you want to say, and you never find out until later, right? You find out later after the marriage has exploded, after the business has gone under, after all the disaster has gone on. Then they come to you, and you go, why didn't you come to me 6 months ago? Well, I knew, you know, I was embarrassed, or, well, you're always so busy, or, well, I thought I could handle it on my own, right? And we get frustrated by that. Let me give you four truths about people and change. This is the first one. In general, most people, if given the choice, would rather be unhappy than uncomfortable. And if you don't believe me, let me just explain this. So a few years ago, I was doing some work. I used to do a lot of work with the U.S. Army. So I got to travel around and visit 40 Army bases a year for 3 years is what I did. And I had to go to Schofield Barracks, which is on Oahu in Hawaii. And it was terrible. The way the government sort of functions sometimes, I had to do 2 days worth of work, but they were 5 days apart. So I had to go to Hawaii for 8 days. Oh, it was terrible, right? Oh. I know. Feel sorry for me. Suffering for me. I know. It's just so much. It's so ugly there, too. So one of my 3 days, I went up to the North Shore, and there's this food truck up there. I'm a bit of a foodie, so be warned. So Giovanni's, right? That shrimp truck. It's amazing. First, when you walk up to it, you think there's no way in the world I'm eating anything that comes off this, because people have scrawled their names all over this truck, and so it looks like a garbage dump. But the food that comes off this thing is amazing. They have three different kinds of shrimp scampi that they make. One is just plain. One is garlic, and one is hot, super hot, super crazy spicy. Yeah. So you go there and you stand in line. You stand in line for like 45 minutes, and then the way it works is you order your food and you get it, and everybody sits at these big picnic tables, and then the table sends somebody to the 7-Eleven across the street to buy some beer and bring it back, and some Coke, I'm sure. people from Fried Hartman are never going to listen. So I'm in line and I'm standing behind this couple, mid late 30s, and strike up a conversation with them as you do. And she is an OBGYN at Cedar Sinai here in Los Angeles, and she's over there volunteering for an inner city clinic in Honolulu. He is a neuroscientist at Stanford Medical Center. Real underachieving couple. Just when I thought I had done something with my life, I ran into these two. But I'm fascinated with the work he does, because Stanford Medical Center is on the cutting edge of memory care and degenerative memory stuff. So he's working, like, he was part of the team that developed the drug Aricept, if you're familiar with that. Delays the progress of degenerative memory loss. And so works with Alzheimer's patients and things like that. So I'm really fascinated because I love brain chemistry. And I ask him, okay, so what have you found? What have you discovered? What's working? What doesn't work? And he said, to be honest with you, this kind of brain research is still so new. Because if you think about it, it hasn't been that long that we've been able to take pictures of the human brain while it's still working. Mm-hmm. Right? Used to be we had to wait until somebody died and then you crack it open and then you try to figure out what happened and reason backwards. But now we can actually take pictures and video of a brain while it's working. So he said, we're just making stuff up now.
Yeah.
We're just trying to see, we're just throwing stuff at the wall to see what sticks. And he said, right now, there are only two things that we know for sure work. Anybody want to guess what they are?
Love.
No? Anybody want to guess? They are the same two things that your doctor will tell you no matter what you go see him for.
Diet and exercise.
Anybody need to write those two down? Right? We all know, don't we? We all know diet and exercise work. And do we do it?
No.
See, this is a big myth that especially those of us in ministry have bought into. We think if people knew better, they would do better. That's not how it works. Because most people have given a choice. They'd rather be unhappy than uncomfortable. I don't like the way my clothes fit. Well, go to the gym. Eat a salad. You know what to do. Diet and exercise. Take a walk.
But that'll make me uncomfortable. I don't want to do that.
So you know what you want to do? This is what people want to do. Most people would rather complain than change.
Yeah.
I don't like whatever it is. And fill in the blank. Now, translate this into your church context. Right? People have complaints about your church. I don't like the way this is. Well, change it.
Well, we've done it this way for so long.
I don't like the way he does that. Well, change it.
Well, but then I had to go dunk him. I wasn't dunking.
Well, you know, because most people, they just want to complain. They don't want to change. This is one of the frustrating things when you're sitting there and a married couple comes to see you. Right? You know where I'm going with this. She spends the first 20 minutes telling you everything that she has been telling him for 20 years, and now she wants you to tell him. That's what she's doing, right? And when you say to her, well, have you ever thought about instead of doing this, maybe you do that? But I didn't want to do that. He's the problem. What is she doing? She would rather complain than change. She would rather be unhappy in her marriage than uncomfortable exploring a new way of relating to her spouse or her kid or whomever. You have people in your church every week, and this describes them, and you're trying to change them, and you wonder why it's not working. Edwin Friedman says, the unmotivated are notoriously immune to insult. Ooh, I just hit somebody, didn't I? Right? Somebody comes in and presents this problem to you. And it's baffling to them. And you page through all of the accumulated wisdom of 25 years in ministry, all of the books that are on that shelf behind you that you actually have, in fact, read, all of the sermons you have delivered, all of the sermons you have heard, and you find the exact pearl at the exact moment, and you drop it on him, and what does he do?
Nothing.
Nothing. He does nothing! Because he's not motivated. And you wonder, what's going on? Most of the people in your church don't want to be helped as much as they want to be heard. And think about this. These people come to see you with a problem that's been keeping them awake for months, maybe years. And you, from behind your desk, go, that's an easy one. Are you kidding? That's it? Oh, here's how you did it. What have you just done? You've completely invalidated it. You've essentially told them they're dumb. And that you are vastly superior to them in every way, shape, and form.
Amen.
And they walk out of there, and they don't feel like they got heard. And why did they come? Because they wanted to be heard. And we want to help. So we go into problem-solving mode. And we essentially treat them as though they are one more problem to be solved. Most people would rather be unhappy than uncomfortable. Most people would rather complain than change. The unmotivated are notoriously immune to insight. And most people don't want to be helped as much as they want to be heard. I want to talk to you about your brain for a little bit. You have this part of your brain sits kind of back at the base of your skull. It's about the size and shape of a grape or an almond, right? It's called your amygdala. Anybody familiar with this? Heard of this before? Right, yeah. So we're going to talk about that here in just a minute. Yeah, exactly. So the amygdala is the most primitive part of the human brain. And it only knows how to do three things. Fight, flight, or freeze. That's it. That's all it knows how to do. Fight, flight, or freeze. Bows up, ready to charge, or run away, run away, run away fast, or deer in the headlights. Play possum. Play dead. Right, that's all it knows how to do. And when you feel threatened, all the energy in your brain rushes to your amygdala. Your brain, that part of your brain specifically is biased towards homeostasis, which is a fancy word for status quo. And homeostasis is a preference for coherence and stability. And any movement, especially sudden movement, is perceived as a threat. Change is viewed as a threat, especially sudden change. Now, you got people in your church who have lived through all kinds of change. We now live in a society where change is norm. Right?
Yep.
Anybody have one of these?
Yep.
Now, I get updates on this. I have three apps that are waiting for updates right now. I had four of them yesterday. And I updated all four of them last night. I have three more now. Why do they have to update everything? I just learned how to do it.
Right.
I finally learned how to do it. Now they've changed the whole thing, you know. We get frustrated with when they update Facebook, right? And what does everybody do? Everybody complains about it, right? Everybody complains. Oh, I like the old Facebook better. I hate it when they put the Messenger app. Oh, why do they have to do that? Ugh, right? We hate it when they change, and it changes before it needs to.
Windows 8.
Right? All the Windows updates, I use a Mac, and so, because I'm one of the chosen people. And, I'm a Christian, so, but we live in a world where change and updates are consistent and normal. But we go to church and we think, oh, at least there's one place in this sorry world where things stay the same. And now some smart aleck know-it-all gets up there and says, we're changing everything around here. No! And what happens when he announces we're changing everything, this time next year it'll look nothing like it looks today. What happens? All the energy in our brains goes whoop, and you can almost divide your church into thirds, right? You got a third who are ready to fight, and a third who are ready to run across town to the other church where they still do it the way they did in the 1950s, and you got a third of them who are just like, and they're just going to play dead until you go away. Because you now are viewed as a threat. You are the threat now. And we wonder what the problem is. And again, we think, well, if they knew better, they'd do better. Here's the problem. Your amygdala, when all of the energy pushes into that part of your brain and your amygdala is hyperstimulated, they can't do anything but those three commands. They can only process three things. Fight, flight, or freeze. And we're trying to have a conversation. And they're trying to figure out if they're going to rush you or run away from you or just stare at you blankly. This is what's wrong with our churches. When people are in heightened states of anxiety, this is how they react to change. One of three ways. They are met with emotional barriers that are usually rooted in some mythology and reinforced by our anxiety. In this category would fall what I refer to as the myth of gradualism. You guys remember gradualism? Oh my goodness. There was an elder in a church when I was growing up who would not let the ministry staff listen to instrumental music on their radios in the office, because he was certain that eventually that was somehow or other going to lead to hard rock concerts on Sunday morning and lesbian preachers. Because that's how gradualism works, right? And I, if I heard this, that story about the camel in the tent one time, I heard it a million times. You guys know what I'm talking about, right? That camel just puts his nose in, and then he puts his foot in, and then eventually he's in, and you're out, right? Gradualism, the slippery slope of gradualism. And if we allow one, if we allow weddings to have instrumental music, then sure enough, it's not going to be long before the youth group is doing it. And if the youth group is doing it, it's not going to be long before... Oh, my word. Give me a break. And what is that? That's a myth. That's mythology. And it's reinforced by our anxiety. So when you introduce change, whoop, I've got an emotional barrier. And here's the thing. We try to rationally argue them out of an emotional anchor. And it doesn't work. Because the argument isn't intellectual. The argument is emotional. The second thing way that people react to change when they're in states of heightened anxiety is imaginative gridlock. Because, like I said, a hyperstimulated amygdala literally shuts down the parts of your brain that allow for imagination and introspection. And here's what that means. I cannot imagine a better way. I cannot imagine a brighter future. I cannot imagine it. And you're saying, try to imagine that. I can't, because that part of my brain literally is shut down. And it shuts down introspection. I can't see my part of the problem. I can't see my role in this whatsoever. You become a lizard. So that's what people who have a hyperstimulated amygdala, sometimes that's referred to as your lizard brain. That's what Seth Godin
pointed out. How long does that stimulation last?
Here's the thing. There are two different kinds of anxiety, right? There is what is called acute anxiety. I remember where I was on 9/11. Right? Most of us remember this. And your anxiety spikes, right? If your anxiety doesn't spike, I might question your patriotism, maybe even your humanity, right? Because anytime I'm part of a group and that group experiences a loss, that's going to cause some anxiety in me. And the thing about acute anxiety, it has a specific cause. We know what caused that. And it has a finite tenure. Eventually, we all went back to life. Right? We're maybe a little bit more cautious. We have some things in place. But that was the president's big push was a return to normalcy. That's what he kept pushing us towards, a return to normalcy. Get out there and spend some money. Go shopping. Relax. Have a meal with your friends. Those kinds of things, right? The problem is there's acute anxiety, and then there is chronic anxiety. We all know people for whom anxiety becomes the normal. We all know people who bring drama with them to the party, right? And they're usually the people who say, oh, I hate drama.
Mm-hmm. Right? They always are.
And yet they're the ones who, if there's no drama, they will stir it up, right? Those people are addicted to anxiety. And that's what happens in individuals, and I've seen it happen in entire congregations, where the congregation is addicted to anxiety. And they don't know how to function without it. And anxiety, unchecked by a leader, a healthy leader, which is what we're going to talk about tomorrow, anxiety unchecked by a healthy leader becomes self-reinforcing. I'm anxious because I'm anxious. And I'm anxious today because I was anxious yesterday. And now I don't know how to function without being caught in this trap, this cycle of chronic anxiety. So I cannot imagine a better future, and I cannot see my part of the problem. The third way of responding or reacting to change is resistance. People stuck in their lizard brain respond to neither reason nor kindness. And some of you know that because you've sat with those people in your office, haven't you? You've sat with that parent who something happened in the youth group. Somebody said something or played a song that had a bad word in it, or something happened in there, and they are there for you to fire the youth minister now. And you try to reason with them, and they cannot have a conversation with you. You try to be kind to them. Can I get you a cup of coffee? Can I get you some water? You seem like a little... No, I don't want your kindness, and I don't want your rational arguments, because I'm literally in my lizard brain. Now, do you understand why this is called a lizard brain? What kind of animal is a lizard? It's a reptile.
Cold-blooded.
It's cold-blooded, right? And what does that mean? What does it mean to be cold-blooded?
You can't regulate the temperature.
Yeah, I can't. My internal body temperature is not self-regulated. It is determined by my environment, right? It's the difference between being a thermometer and a thermostat. A thermostat says, look, whatever you do, I'm going to be 72 degrees. If I need to turn on the air conditioning, if I need to turn on the heater, whatever, I'm going to be 72 degrees. A thermometer cannot control itself. All it does is tell you the temperature of the room. And there are people in your church who cannot control themselves. They are controlled by their environment. And when the environment is calm, they can be calm. But when the environment is chaotic, then they become chaotic. They have lost control of themselves. By the way, the fruit of the Spirit is self-control. That's why this is important. And we'll talk a little bit more about that tomorrow. But anxious people move towards three places. First one is denial. What problem? I don't know what you're talking about. A new minister comes in and says, hey, you guys see that? Nope. Well, how long has that been going on? I don't know what you're talking about. What problem? There is no problem here. We need to talk, and Sean and I talk about this a lot, we need to talk about race in the church. We don't have a race problem in the church. We don't have a race problem in America. You heard people say that? This is a post-racial society. We had a black president, for crying out loud. So how bad can it be? What problem? What problem? I don't know. I don't see a problem here. We need to talk about what women can and can't do. Why would you bring that up? You're causing problems. I'm not causing problems. I just turned a light on. That's all I did. You ever done that in a church where you come in and they blame you for causing... I got anonymous mail to my house. Satan sent you here to split this church. All I did was turn a light on. I did not cause the split. I revealed the split. I uncovered the split. I named the split. I didn't cause it. It was here. What problem? We don't have any problems here. Denial. That's a sign of chronic anxiety. Second one, despair. Oh, what's the use? Oh, it'll never work. Oh, my sister-in-law goes to a church and they tried that and it didn't work and they split the church and now they've closed their doors. That's probably what's going to happen here. Rooted in mythology, reinforced by our anxiety, by the way. Denial, despair, or this is the other one. Oh, this one's my favorite. Magic. Is there a silver bullet out there?
Yeah.
What if we preach the story? I bet that would solve all of our problems. Don't get me wrong, the story is fine. Don't I mean, it's a good curriculum. You can buy that. But don't expect that. What about 40 days of whatever? 40 days of purpose. 40 days of hope. 40 days of 1 week to live. Somewhere out there on the shelf of some Lifeway Christian bookstore is some silver bullet that we could buy in a box and bring it here and open it up and it will solve all of our problems.
Swiffers.
Swiffers, or you know, if we just got a new youth minister, or let's bring in a praise team that's going to solve all of our problems, or okay, fine, we'll add a band on Sunday nights. That's going to solve all of your problems. Like bad instrumental music is better than you know whatever. The only thing worse than no instruments is bad instruments. But we're looking for these things as a silver bullet. Like that's going to be magic. And if we just hire the right person or get the right thing or the right curriculum or preach the right sermons, everything's going to fall into place. Chronically anxious people love magic. And shysters and salesmen that see that a mile away. Let me tell you what you need. You need a gymnasium. We'll call it a family life center. And you can do upwards basketball, and you can do a summer camp a sports camp in the summer, and that's going to solve all your problems. Just sign here and go $10 million into debt, and oh, it's going to be great. It'll pay for itself in 5 years. That's a chronically anxious person that's looking for magic. We didn't get into these problems overnight. We're not going to get out of them overnight. There are five problems that exist in your church, and only five. And if you can come up with one that doesn't fall into one of these five buckets, I will put it in the book and give you credit for it. But I'm telling you, there are five problems. This is what's wrong with your church. Your church is rooted in chronic anxiety. You have people in your church, some of them in positions of leadership, who are addicted to anxiety. And they, so much so that they allow anxiety to make their decisions for them. And I'm just telling you, chronically anxious people have a place in your church. You must never show them where the keys or the checkbook are. Because chronically anxious people make notoriously bad decisions. Chronically anxious people will sabotage your church by choosing to protect their assets rather than advancing your mission. Because when you allow anxiety to make your decisions for you, you end up with the very outcome you were hoping to avoid. You have chronically anxious people in positions of leadership, and because the leadership is so anxious, and because the leadership oftentimes cannot define success for the organization in a common sort of way, you end up with polarized parties. And you have people in your church who have different definitions of what a good Sunday is. And so you can have a Sunday morning service, and some of your people will go away thinking that is the best Sunday morning we have ever had. And some of those people will leave the exact same service and say, if that ever happens again here, I am leaving. And they become polarized. And when they become polarized, they draw lines in the sand, and now it's us against them, and they start shooting each other. They start throwing darts at each other. And so how do we tend to solve that problem? Because we think the problem is the problem, but the problem is usually underneath the problem. In fact, the problem, in many ways, is, from the other person's perspective, a solution to the problem. So we say, okay, we've got polarized parties. We've got different people who have different perspectives on pick an issue. You want to do women's roles, or you want to do instrumental music, or do you want to do Can the Baptists Go to Heaven, or whatever it is. Whatever it is, here's how are we going to solve it? We're either going to deny it, what problem? And we're going to just preach fundamentals. Let's preach the things we can all agree on, right? Meanwhile, everybody knows, well, we can agree on this, but over the big issues. Or we'll say, here's what we're going to do. We're going to spend 26 weeks studying whether or not Baptists are saved. And at the end of the 26 weeks, is the problem solved?
No.
No, not at all. Because the problem's not the problem. You know what the problem is? Lack of clarity regarding your mission. You want to unite people? You don't focus on what unites them doctrinally. You don't focus on what divides them doctrinally. You focus on a common mission. Because people band shoulder to shoulder. And the problem with a lot of churches is they have no idea what their mission is. And because they're not clear regarding their mission, they end up having bad boundaries. And they don't realize it's possible for you to say no to people. When people overstep. And they think anybody, everybody, has power and authority to chastise this person or that person or call that person out or to fire that person. You can't fire him, you know. It's weird. People think they have the right to demand that you be fired. It's weird that in churches, people who have a sixth grade education feel like they can call somebody out who has spent 20 years studying the text in the original language. Well, that's not what it means. That's what every scholar ever agrees that it means. Well, that's not what it means. That's not what it means to me. That's not what Bethel Barrett Baxter said. As if he was speaking ex cathedra, right? You got bad boundaries, and then this is the worst one right here. An unwillingness to confront divisive and destructive behavior. And you know why? You know why we are unwilling to confront divisive and destructive behavior? Because we're afraid they'll leave. We would rather them stay and be destructive and divisive. How? That's a special category of dumb. Right? I mean, that falls under a very specific theological category. Thou shalt not be dumb. We would rather them stay and be destructive and divisive than say, if you're not going to get on board, get out. Why are you here? These are the five problems that exist in every church. They're the only five problems that exist in churches. Every problem you have fits into at least one of these. And some of you are thinking, well, I think we have all five of them right now, right? Yeah. And I want you to know, you're not alone. There are ways to deal with all of these problems, but we don't have time to discuss that today. In fact, I'm a couple minutes over. Let me pray for you, and then I'll see you tomorrow. We'll talk about some solution. God, thank you so much for every person in this room. Thank you for their hearts and their minds and their bodies. Thank you that we have brains. Thank you that we have agency, that we can get up and do things. Thank you for the clear and secure knowledge that all it takes is one person saying it's not going to end this way to change an entire culture. More than anything, thank you for Jesus, who shows us just how real that statement is. And we pray all this in his name. Amen. I'll see you guys tomorrow.